close the door?
Thank you. Well, welcome everybody. We have a contingent of students here from Shanghai, so I want to welcome them. Welcome to Stanford. Welcome to my class. Students went to Will Garage on last Thursday. How cool was that? It was awesome. What did you like best? What was most surprising or the thing that you liked the best? Anybody?
Yeah,
Richard. I liked the interior of the robot.
The inside, what went into it?
Yeah.
There's a lot of little parts, right?
Yeah,
and they all have to work, right?
What else? What else impressed you?
Yeah, bring it.
I liked how the interface was able to see the robot over the head as opposed to just what the camera sees.
Right. So what Raymond's talking about is that the robot with its 3D sensor can determine what's out in the environment, but it also knows where it is in relationship with all that, and the image that's shown to the user includes both the robot and the environment. Yeah. What else? Anything else that really impressed you? It wasn't moving around a lot. It was pretty much stationary, but it was good. Yeah.
I guess seeing how they tackle the problems associated with the control system and everything.
Right. You know, I mentioned at the Will Garage that, you know, being a person with a disability has a unique interface needs, and so in order for them to make a good interface that works for him, the interface turned out to be good for everybody. So that's sort of interesting to know. So the agenda today, just a few administrative things, then we'll get into a little discussion. We'll have a short break and a demo after class. So let's move on. So for students working on team projects, the activities you should be undertaking are the empathy phase of your project, understanding what the problem is. From that, determining what's needed, figuring out what other people have done, what other products and research are out there that attempted to solve the problem, and why those aren't good solutions. Then you want to brainstorm to figure out how you could tackle the problem, and maybe come up with your top three concepts. And from those top three, you're going to be selecting one or more to pursue for your project. And I met with a lot of students already, and it'd be good to meet once again before the midterm presentation, which is 2 weeks from Thursday. So so please get in touch with me to arrange a meeting with your team. And it's really important that you let me know how well you're progressing. So anytime you've made a certain breakthrough or talk to different people, just let me know a couple sentences by email. That way I know that you're really working on this on your project. There's a number of students who haven't named their team, so if you've gotten together and can figure out a name that represents your team, that would be great, because I need that information to refer to you for the midterm presentations. And you should have a name for the project as well. And actually, if you're building a device, the device should have a name as well. So all those things, naming could be a big thing. For students working on team projects, I expect that your expenses will be low, maybe a couple $100. So what you need to do now is, when you buy things, keep the receipts. If you have a question on whether or not a particular purchase is appropriate, just let me know and I can make that determination on the spot. There's a whole page on the reimbursement procedure, but that should be done at the end of the quarter. Okay. There are 6 people I got shop passes for. I haven't been able to get any. I think it's gone through, and I think those people should be able to use the shop now. So that's that. Any questions at this point on your projects, on the course, anything at all? Okay. So today's discussion is on Well, first we're going to talk about Henry Evans. Henry was the fellow at Will Garage. And I just wanted to point out a couple of the devices that he used. So one of the software things that did the text-to-speech is the Speech Easy API that was actually done by a guy here at Stanford. And so it's a way to have text-to-speech on Linux systems. And he used the software to create his synthetic voice. And what was really impressive for me is that speech synthesizer pronounced my name correctly. So, I mean, that's a key thing for me, that it pronounced it correctly. I'm not sure if it did that automatically or he had to, sort of create that. So Henry used this device called a Tracker Pro, which sits on his laptop, and it uses the position of a reflective marker. And reflective markers are very easy to see when you take a flash picture of them. They stand out like this. So with this, he's able to control the cursor, and he uses this on-screen keyboard. So instead of moving, typing on a keyboard, he can move the cursor around with his head and typically positioning it over a key for a certain length of time will cause that key to be entered. And here it's going into Notepad. And from Notepad, he can send it to the speech synthesizer for it to be spoken. So what he did was his little talk and joke was all pre-edited. He didn't do that on the fly because it takes a long time to, pick out letters one by one using his head. But those are all pre-edited. And Stephen Hawking uses a similar system, and all the things that he does are pretty much pre-edited. If you have to wait for a response for him to generate a response, you're going to be waiting a while because it takes a while. So you might have seen his wife using this communication board, and if you look very closely, there's like eight areas. There's an upper left, upper middle, upper right, and each one of these sections has three letters in it. So by gazing a certain way, by looking through it and figuring out where Henry is looking, she can figure out what he's trying to say letter by letter. It takes a long time, and there's a certain amount of guesswork that goes on, too. Typically, a person like Henry and the person he's communicating with on a regular basis, they have a rapport and you can sort of guess after a while, what he's trying to say. So that's Henry. But I want to talk about failure today. Now, this may seem like a sort of unusual topic because failure typically is thought of as a very negative thing, but I'm going to tell you otherwise. So a lot of things have been said about failure. Is it always a negative thing? Is it something always to avoid? Is failure the opposite of success? There's all sorts of postures that indicate failure. So, when you talk about success, one of the big slogans out there is, if at first you don't succeed, try again. But if you happen not to succeed on your first try, maybe you don't want to take up skydiving. Okay. And this is another famous quote, failure is not an option. And who was around for Apollo 13? Okay, you're the old people, okay? But as you recall, from the movie maybe, that Apollo 13, had a problem going to the moon and they had to get back and, they said failure is not an option. Who knows why failure was not an option? There's two reasons. Yes, you don't want the three astronauts to die. And what was the sort of secondary reason? Yes.
It's a little political, but weren't the Russians almost close to
it? Yeah, you're very close. It's about, national prestige. We're putting all our scientific effort into this thing. It's made public. It's on TV all the time. If three astronauts were killed, that would really wreck the space program and our the prestige as a nation. So that's why failure was not an option. But in reality, failure is always an option because you can't guarantee that you're going to succeed. And that's what Adam Savage says. And you can tell this is true because it's on a t-shirt. You can buy a t-shirt. So you always have to consider failure in what you're doing. You know, it may not be something that you want to have, but it's an option. So a lot of people have said a lot of things about failure. How many people know who Mary Pickford is? You're the really old people. She was a silent movie star. She said, failure's not falling down. It's not getting up again. So failure has two points. You know, there's the point of creating the failure and then what you do after that happens. So the observation here is you shouldn't give up after you've had a setback. And Thomas Edison says, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work. So what was he talking about here? What was he getting all these failures on? What was he trying to do? Light bulb. He was trying to create a filament that would glow and not be consumed, right? So his method was to try everything. He tried every material. He had things coated with other things and tried lots of different things. And so he just used a process where he just tried every possible option. But, you know, if you have to try, you know, 10,000 things, you know, you might not have a good understanding of what the problem is or the science behind it. So that's, you know, maybe not a good thing. And 3 weeks ago, I sat next to Seth Shostak, who's an astronomer at SETI, and I noticed a little bit of a resemblance. So I'm not sure he knows about that, but I'll let him know if I see him next time. Okay, so who is this guy here? He says if you want to increase your success rate, double your failure rate. So I take that to mean you need to prototype more and prototype faster. And you'll find success on the far side of failure. So maybe you need to experience failure before you can achieve success. Maybe the pathway to success is through failure. So which company does this guy work for? Students first.
Two?
IBM, that's right. And so you might be familiar with Watson, the computer program, and there's a similarity in their names. So Think was the model of IBM. I saw this in an ad, fail faster, succeed sooner. So maybe the more times, the faster you fail, the closer you get to success. And other people have said, accept failure and learn from it. It's a temporary detour. It can be a valuable experience. So when you think about all these things, you see failure in a more positive light. Ben Franklin said, failure to prepare is preparing to fail. So that means incorporate failure into your design process because it's going to happen. And then we go from a founding father to a cartoon father. Trying is the first step toward failure. So you can avoid failure by not even making an attempt, okay? But that's not very good because, I mean, we're here to take a chance on something, right? And indeed, Dave Beach says embrace failure. So if you're embracing this concept because you know it's going to lead to your success. And John Keith says failure is the highway to success. So failure is a part of the process. Okay? So the messages I'm giving you from all this is you need to prototype early and often. Use whatever means you can to envision your design. Employ your knowledge, sense of skills, and your engineering intuition. Make good use of other people and the resources and knowledge they have. And most important, you have to manage your time because it's going to be limited. You know, the end of the quarter is fast approaching, so it's your most valuable resource. Don't expect a linear path of successes from the beginning of your project to the end. prepare to make mistakes and experience failures and plan for them, understand them, and learn from them. This is a really key thing. If you make a mistake, you know, you can say, why didn't this work? What should I have done to make this work? So don't get discouraged and don't give up. So a couple items. We talked about Apollo 13. Would you characterize that as a success or a failure?
Successful landing.
Successful landing. The astronauts weren't killed, right? So was there an Apollo 14 and 15 and 16? So despite this failure, they learned something from it and were able to succeed on subsequent missions. So even though this is a single point of failure, the whole space endeavor was a positive one, successful one. Anybody disagree with that? Okay. Here we have the Concorde on the last flight. So it sucked up something from the runway from another plane, and it got caught in the engine, and the engine blew up, and it crashed. So how many passenger flights of Concorde happened after that? How many passengers were on Concorde after that? Zero. They stopped. They took all the Concordes out of service. There wasn't another Concorde flight except for one that just had the pilot in it to take it back to France or wherever. So it operated for many years. It was very expensive, but a lot of people used it. Was the Concorde a success or failure? Success. In some ways, it was a success while I was operating. But did they ever try to resolve this problem? No. So maybe you can think of it as an ultimate failure. The last thing it did was kill people. That's not very positive. Okay. So what ultimately determines a project's success or failure? How about if you had a failure and you learned from it and you continued and you got to the end of the course or the end of your process and were able to build something? That would be successful. If you came upon a failure and didn't learn from it and didn't do anything after that and gave up, then that's a failure, in my mind. Okay? So, next Thursday ought to be another great lecture. We're having two students who took the course last year and have graduated. And just to give you evidence that there's life after Stanford, they're going to come back and talk to you about their experiences out in the real world after Stanford. And I think you'll enjoy it. And today we have a couple folks from Roto Mobility who I'll introduce after a short break. So if you're a student, haven't signed up yet, or haven't gotten a cookie, please do that. I encourage students to take these evaluation forms and fill them out, and also other people in the audience, if you want to evaluate, please come up and grab one of these forms. I encourage everybody to do so, and I value your evaluation. Okay? Stand by for 2 minutes. Hi. Oh, you didn't get another cookie?
Oh, boy.
How you doing? Yeah, I'm doing good. Oh, you're taking two.
Good guy.
Okay.
We're going to leave a little early today because we've got to go to another class.
Okay.
A couple questions. Gal in the back with the gray hair, the black lady.
Yeah.
I don't know her name.
Yeah, I forgot her name. Yeah, I know you got distracted by...
I just left my hair.
You filled it out already?
Yeah.
You haven't even heard the lecture.
I know, I like it. I'm not a good critic.
Got one? You have one? Yes. Yeah. Want to fill one of these out? Hey, want to fill one of these out? After. Welcome. Okay. You're busy. Oh, okay.
Great, thank you.
Got one, Laura?
No. Okay, so it's not.
No.
Will you make any kind of an appeal for funds?
Not publicly right now. Maybe.
Email maybe?
Yeah. No. Okay. Perspective as a startup company working in the field of assistive technology. So it's a little bit different perspective than you've had before, but I think you'll find it enlightening. So Michael has earned graduate and undergraduate degrees in both engineering and business, and Chris was educated at the University of London in material science, and he's had over 30 years of expertise designing, building, and selling equipment for the semiconductor and other high-tech industries. So I'll let Michael take it away.
Well, thank you, Dave. Yes, so our company is Rota, and we're designing and building some pretty innovative and, we believe, cool wheelchairs here locally. Not too far away, actually. So Stanford, you can see where we are now. And we're here in the South Bay in Los Gatos where we design them, and we have a factory in San Jose. So just about 20 minutes away. We've also had the opportunity to work with a few of Dave's classes in the past, which has been great. This community is growing here at Stanford, and it's been very beneficial for us. So in 2011, we did a project, and in 2012, we did two projects. This year, we're going into volume production for Rota products, so we've been focused on that. But Dave, thank you for those opportunities. What we want to discuss today is very simple, really. How we design, how we build, and then have a bit of a discussion with you to see what questions you have, and maybe we can answer some of that through our experience. But really, we're going to go through a story of how we started up our company, and hopefully there's a few takeaways that you guys will have along the way. So how do we design? So it started with empathy for us. A family member of ours had MS and was in a wheelchair. And what he found was there was a lot of challenges in his life that we wanted to see if we could contribute to helping him with. And we like building things, so naturally we gravitated towards Rota as a project. If you look at manual wheelchairs, they're really hard work. They're really hard work on the flat. They're really hard work when you go uphill. They're really hard work when you go downhill. Everybody knows that they're a common prosthesis, but they're a very tough prosthesis for those people that they're in them. They were designed for really pushing people, not for, you know, people pushing themselves. So that's really where we started from. They're very painful, so the medical community has realized that they're hard work and that they're painful. So when you look to designing something, don't only look to what the user suffers, but also what the medical community acknowledges is a problem. Because if you have both of those with you as you start designing something, you have both the user and the medical community on your side as you go through the process. It was not only painful for our cousin, but it also made him stay at home a lot. And while that can't be really measured in a scale of pain, the term is well-being. And his well-being in his life was severely compromised, meaning he wasn't getting much social activity. As we kept on visiting him year after year, he was getting a little bit grumpier. And that wasn't a factor of necessarily just the pain that he was suffering as a result of MS, but the social aspects of his life, he was inside and he was used to being with himself. And when somebody came by and said hello, his initial reaction wasn't welcoming. So well-being is another thing that with great assistive technology you can solve or help. And the other thing is we were very much inspired to create a better wheelchair because there was no healthy alternative. And that goes for everybody that's in a manual wheelchair. Eventually, they're led into a power scooter where they have no possibility of physical exercise. And then their health decelerates and later in their life. So they get more overweight. They get grumpier. They start taking more painkillers. Their blood levels change. So there's a lot of reasons why we wanted to design a better wheelchair. And that's another health reason. We factored in just a few things that we wanted to address with the wheelchair at the very beginning. And that was, what could we do that was better than what was existing? Are there any alternatives to pushing on the hand rims? What's the best exercise for the upper body? Because that's what users have, just their upper body. And are there some other problems with wheelchairs that are kind of second order? So that's kind of how we looked at it. We went to very basic questions, not just designing something right away. When we looked at the alternative,